Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Millions of us go into the air every day and land in a different city or country, lofted on an incredibly complex air traffic control system. There have been a series of embarrassing reports lately of air traffic controllers caught napping or watching their DVDs. No one got hurt, but it still signals that something is rotten in the system that runs the jet age. This hour on Point, air traffic controllers asleep at the switch and a world of problems in our nation's skies. You can join the conversation. Are snoozing air traffic controllers like the canary in the coal mine, a sign that something worse is coming? Do we have too many planes in the skies? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first this hour from Greenwich, Connecticut, is Christine Negroni. She writes on aviation for the New York Times and runs a blog called Flying Lessons. She's also the author of Deadly Departure, Why the Experts Failed to Prevent the TWA Flight 800 Disaster and How It Could Happen Again. Christine, welcome to On Point.
Well, hello, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice to have you. There's been this string of stories about air traffic controllers falling asleep on the job. Put it all into context for us. How many incidents are we talking about?
Well, I think as of this morning, we're up to seven. That could change at any moment, but right now we're at seven. To put it in context, is about as complicated a question as the system itself. Because I think people's initial reaction is, what's wrong with these people? Why are they not doing their jobs? And, you know, this is a behavioral problem. But I think it's really much more than that. I think in some respects it's behavioral, in some respects it's systemic, and if it sends one clear message, it is that the problem of fatigue is a constant in aviation, it's a constant in air traffic, it's a constant with pilots and flight attendants, and it hasn't yet been addressed. So I'd say that's probably the big lesson coming out of it.
Yesterday at a press conference in Atlanta, FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt said that flight controllers sleeping on the job would simply not be tolerated.
It absolutely has to stop. I was absolutely infuriated when I heard the first one or two, but as we began our review, it became even more frustrating and it was more disappointing to me.
What's been the government response to all this, Christine?
I'm frustrated when I hear the administrator taking an approach that this is something that needs to be punished. Yes, in some cases, in the most recent case, in which a controller in Cleveland was watching a movie when he should have been managing traffic.
His microphone was inadvertently activated, which was transmitting the audio of the film.
Exactly. Now, that's a behavioral issue. Now, that's the sort of thing when the administrator gets up there and talks tough. You know, I don't think anyone's going to quibble with it. But from the beginning, Administrator Babbitt has taken this approach that it's intolerable, it's wrong, it's this, it's that, and I think it minimizes a much larger problem. As I said, I'm frustrated by that. A lot of these air traffic controllers are not bringing a pillow and blanket to work. They are working in a hard, mentally fatiguing job in which their shifts change every 2 days. Every third day they do an overnight. Any person who's familiar with body rhythms will tell you that's not maximizing human performance. That actually works against human performance. And yet there doesn't seem to be a serious approach until now to dealing with that problem. Now,
so are we looking at new guidelines here? I mean, Christine, we've got new rules that have been phased in this week for air traffic controllers.
And look how fast that happened, Jane. I mean, that went from having discussed the fatigue issue for probably 10 years, maybe longer, from having discussed it for that long to bad publicity for the agency and the union, and all of a sudden we have changes in rules in less than a week. What does that tell you? It tells you that they're taking a knee-jerk reaction to what is a systemic problem, and I don't think that that's the appropriate way to handle this.
So the FAA has suspended 9 controllers and supervisors since late March. These new rules, however effective they may be, mandate the 8 hours between shifts increases to 9 hours off, and scheduling a midnight shift after midnight in order to arrange a 3-day weekend is no longer acceptable. Anything else that you find significant
here? You know, I'll tell you, I think one of the more promising things to emerge from this is what's happening. It might start this week. It might start next. It's not. I'm not frankly clear off the top of my head. But they're doing this call to action, sort of visit around the country to air traffic control centers around the country, and that is both members of the FAA and members of the union. And they are going, and they are reminding controllers of exactly, you know, how to do their jobs responsibly, and listening to them about what areas in the system, what ways of operating are not working to maximize their performance. So I think that's probably more promising. You know, it's not, I hate to be sounding like I'm, you know, completely ragging on the FAA on this. This just as much responsibility goes to the union to be speaking to its members. And now some of these, you have to know, some of these air traffic controllers were not union members, they were supervisors. But, you know, from the perspective of the air traveler, you know, they're thinking of them all as the same. But to supervisors, to the union, to the FAA, for all of them to sort of man up here and say, look, there's appropriate behavior, there's inappropriate behavior, and there's appropriate ways to handle people in these high-stress, high-performance jobs, and there's inappropriate ways. And right now, we're skittering too much on the wrong side of all of those questions.
Christina Groney, let me bring in another voice into the conversation now from Winnetka, Illinois, Aaron Gelman. He's a professor at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University and an expert in civil aviation and air traffic control issues. He's also a member of the FAA's Subcommittee on Air Traffic Management. Professor Gelman, welcome to you.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. What do you make of all this? I mean, it's not just air traffic controllers sleeping on the job, frankly. I mean, we've had so many incidents in the last little while, planes clipping each other on runways, pilots flying straight past their destination cities. I mean, what do you make of all this?
Well, before I address the sleeping issue, I think it's a far bigger issue as to why NextGen, the new technology for air traffic management, is taking so slow to be deployed. But we'll come back to that if there's time.
Well, let's address it right now, because I keep reading about this, these old IBM computers that are still running air traffic control. I mean, how much does this old technology contribute to some of these issues and some of the problems that we're talking about?
Well, I don't think the sleeping issue has anything to do with
that.
Well,
of course.
But I do believe that the technology, as I say, it's called Next Gen, is pretty much there, and very little progress is being made. And I think it's very clear that it's due to a lack of leadership for a very long time at the FAA and at DOT. And I think that's not going to change as a result of this sleeping problem, fatigue problem, as it was referred to. I think the problems with the fatigue issue start with the question of how the intake is chosen at the academy that the FAA runs for controller training and education. By that I mean, what are the criteria for getting into that school at Oklahoma City? And I think that we need to focus on the merit of the people, and no other things take priority over merit. And I think we've been hiring people for the control positions based on not just merit, but also on social considerations and other things like that. And I think merit has to be number one, two, and three, as they say about real estate, being a location three times.
I want to get back to that next-gen satellite system in a bit. First, let's hear from Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood. He told CBS's The Early Show that policies can be changed, but that controllers will not be paid to take naps.
Controllers have to take personal responsibility. We can have all the rules and regulations. We can set better rest times and other things. But in the end, controllers have to make sure they get the right rest, that they come to work rested, and that's part of taking personal responsibility.
There you hear Ray LaHood, Aaron Gelman. How do you see it? I mean, sleep specialists.
Well, my reaction to that is two. One, Ray LaHood shouldn't be saying this. The secretary should know enough about leadership that's the kind of thing that Randy Babbitt should be saying, not Ray LaHood. Randy Babbitt is the head of the FAA. The secretary should not be the one that's saying that sort of thing. It demoralizes FAA people to have the secretary step in where the FAA's responsibility really is clearly located there at the FAA. Secondly, I think that it is critically important to understand as the previous guest was talking about, that the union has an important role or important cross to bear here. The union is not a craft union. We've lost a lot of craft unions. If you recall, historically, we used to have craft unions and industrial unions. The craft unions dedicated themselves in part to making the membership aware of the future of their careers and help them make them better, training, education, and so on. This union doesn't do that. This union seems to be only interested in maximizing the number of dues-paying members. And if the craft union mentality had infused the Air Traffic Controllers Association, then I think these people would not be sleeping so much, not be performing the way they do in many cases, not in all cases.
Christine Negroni, jump in here. I mean, you talked earlier about a systemic problem. Professor Gelman's talking about union issues. I mean, is this at the core about leadership? Where do you see this? What is this about at the heart of it?
Well, I have heard this complaint about the criteria used for hiring controllers. I'm not read enough about it to have an opinion on it, though I have to say I've heard it as well. So that, you know, that is burbling around that there, you know, that there are issues in air traffic control or hiring. I'm gonna disagree a little bit with what he says about the union. I have seen, and again, you know, my perspective is not as yours is, Professor. I see it as a journalist, but I have seen quite a lot of activity among members of NATCA in the safety forum, you know, in which I am also a participant.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about the recent spate of air traffic controllers falling asleep in their control towers, watching DVDs instead of their radar screens, and other air safety incidents that have been in the news. My guests this hour are Christine Negroni, who writes on aviation for the New York Times and runs a blog called Flying Lessons, and Aaron Gelman, who's a member of the FAA's Subcommittee on Air Traffic Management and an expert on aviation at Northwestern University. A couple of listener comments from our Facebook page. Sam Blackman says, is it safe to fly? No. Between the rent-a-thugs at the TSA checkpoints to the overworked and surly flight attendants, the sleeping air traffic controllers, drinking pilots, ready to fall apart planes, no. 1,000 times, no. And then this from Kristen Kiefer from Facebook, who says, I find the emergency landing of the recent Southwest flight much more unnerving than the sleeping air traffic controllers. I have to fly for business, don't look forward to passing through security, drive when I can, but still see flying as a necessity that is safe. Let's talk about the passenger perspective on all this, Christine and Aaron. What about it? You know, it often seems so unpleasant to fly. The planes are packed, no legroom, prices are going up. I mean, and then all this that's been heading our way as the flying public in the last few weeks. What do you say to consumers these days, Christine?
Flying is safe to fly. There's no doubt about that. It is the safest way to get around, and that involves both domestic and international. I don't think anybody should equate what goes on at the TSA checkpoints with flying. That isn't flying. It's part of the experience of flying, but it is not flying. Flying is safer than anything else, and of course there are going to be cases where you have some problems. I'm not talking only about the sleeping controllers, which I think is, in the end, a very minor threat to aviation safety, because there are alternative ways of handling traffic when a tower, for example, doesn't answer, as happened at Reagan National a few weeks ago. But I think it's important to recognize that the FAA and the union are much more reactive than proactive. And they have got to change to be more proactive and look at the future and stop reacting to what has already been presented to them as a fact.
Christine Negroni, jump in here.
Well, I think he's right. And that's the point I was making earlier about what takes 10 years to study takes a week to implement when the pressure's on. And that's a completely reactive response. And in terms of And I'll tell you the danger of that is tomorrow it will be something else. So, for example, the A380 collision on the runway. Now everyone's attention is focused on that. So now there'll be some sort of knee-jerk reaction to that. And then what will it be now? And then the Southwest depressurization event. So these are all real issues. I'm not saying they're not real issues. But so long as the leadership wants to sort of jump on what the newspapers are on or what Twitter is on, there's not a sensible, smart, responsible, proactive, as the professor says, response to aviation.
Let's get a couple of callers in here, Christine.
By the way, one last
okay,
point.
Professor.
I think one of the things that I would like to see done is the FAA take a serious look at how supervisors are selected.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the supervisors' relationship to the line controllers is a very important issue that has not been paid a lot of attention to. And I think that there is a part of the problems that we're facing in the air traffic system today.
Let's hear from a pilot on this in Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Well, how you doing?
Fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, I've got to say, the aviation system that I am in, and I've been flying for a major airline for 25 years, is a good system, very safe. I wouldn't consider anything unsafe that happens. There's so many layers of protection. We can't take what we find in the media that's reported in the media to heart, really, because it's so infrequent. I do have to address the FAA's issue with controllers and fatigue, as well as pilots and fatigue. When we're on a long trip, international flight, we're flying over 8 hours. We have a relief pilot. And we get a break, 2-hour break. We get to go back. We get to sleep in the middle of the night. We come back up. We're refreshed and ready to go for the landing the next morning when we arrive. Now, the FAA will not allow their controllers to sleep even on their breaks, which is just absurd. If you guys got a 1-hour lunch break, he takes 15, 20 minutes, has something to eat, goes back and takes a 20-minute nap. He's going to come back at 3 o'clock in the morning a lot more refreshed than if he's forced to stay awake for his full 8-hour shift or however long the shifts are at the FAA.
Mike, thank you. I'm glad you called with that pilot perspective. Here's Sherry in Des Moines, Iowa, with another view. Sherry, welcome.
Hi. This is not just a fatigue issue for pilots or air traffic controllers. It's a fatigue issue for drivers and other safety critical people. And it's a management issue and scheduling. I get so tired of hearing that it's very easy to blame the driver or blame the pilot. But like Christina, I think, said,
mm-hmm.
They study the issue or they avoid looking at scheduling for X number of years until some issue happens. And then, like I said, it's easy to blame the driver or blame the controller. And that is not what the problem is. There's people in multiple industries working ridiculous schedules that are primed for fatigue, and they don't want to address the issue because of money.
Systemic management problems, your point. Sherry, thank you. Thank you for calling. Let's bring another voice in from San Diego. Here's Bill Voss. He's CEO of the Flight Safety Foundation, which is an independent, nonprofit, international organization whose membership is made up of airlines, manufacturers, labor, and management, and others. Nice to have you with us, Bill. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
So with the string of incidents that we've been talking about, what's your take? Are we reaching the natural limits of our air traffic control system?
Well, I think we've reached the natural limits of absurdity, really. As the previous callers lined out, it's been over 20 years now since the studies have been done showing the dramatic positive effect that even short periods of rest have on your mental performance. And I'm sitting here right now, sitting in front of my PC, looking at the studies showing that everybody, if the controller does everything right on a variety of different shifts, at the end of that shift, they're somewhere below functioning a bit worse than if they were legally drunk. And if they're allowed to take a 20-minute nap sometime during the period, which is they're on break anyway, so who cares, they come back perfectly refreshed and ready to handle anything.
So you heard Secretary Ray LaHood saying earlier, we're not paying people to take naps on the job. And what's the change here? How do you make this change? What's the politics behind all this?
Someone just has to get past the politics. Is that position is irresponsible, given the overwhelming data that's there. You're basically saying, I will willingly put people at risk, and I will put people back on the road to drive home with your families who are impaired to the point as if they were drunk. And I'm willing to do that rather than admit to the public that I need to allow sleeping on my shifts. And that's just a pure indication of politics clearly being more important than the actual safety of the public.
You've got a lot of players in this political orbit, from general aviation groups, labor movements, airlines. I mean, help us understand the politics of managing all that.
Well, there's a tremendous the FAA has always got a problem with politics. And, for example, the FAA took on very aggressively after the Colgan crash this very dangerous systemic fatigue problem with pilots. And much effort was thrown in, and actually the FAA did a brilliant job and showed a lot of leadership at that point. And if you look around, you'll have to notice that there's no new rule for fatigue. It gently got picked apart by various interest groups, and we're now back to the drawing board position. And that is fairly normal. The FAA does work within a group of special interests that have an amazing way of, you know, dismantling whatever happens. And that has always been a problem, is one of the big reasons that you don't see the FAA stepping out aggressively on issues, because they know the likelihood that they'll be beaten back.
Bill, let me bring a caller in on this point. David is in Hammond, New York. Hi, David. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm a over-the-road professional truck driver, and we deal with fatigue all the time.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, it's a case of personal responsibility.
Yes.
If you cannot do the job and stay awake while you're doing the job, then find another line of work, for God's sake.
David, thank you. Christine Negroni, what do you
Not
make of that?
Not the same thing. Not the same thing. Fatigue is the same thing. He's right about that. But if you're an over the road driver and you start to feel tired, you can pull your rig over and take a nap. An air traffic controller cannot do that, especially in the period before these second controllers were brought on. They can't just step out and say, I'm going to take a nap, for one thing. We've already heard Ray LaHood's comment on that. But for another, the personnel wasn't there. So there's that. There's also, this is not a, I think the thing that sort of frustrates me on this matter is, this is a mental exertion that has its own toll. We're not talking about a physical exertion. It's a mental exertion. You need to be on task. You need to be on point. You need to be constantly vigilant about this. Look, Bill used to be an air traffic controller. I know he can speak more specifically to it. But as all of the air traffic control, and then going to what the professor said about next gen, as all of the air traffic control gets more complicated, and all of, you know, with next gen, and both pilots and air traffic controllers wind up be doing more of a monitoring function, that mental fatigue will only get worse. Because all the studies show that the more automation that comes into these complex tasks, the more fatiguing it is to the brain.
Bill Voss, so jump in. Go ahead.
The problem now.
Well, sure. That is true. It's just human beings make very poor monitors, and they have to work very, very hard to force themselves to continue to monitor. And actually, in the cockpit side, that's now accounting for a lot of the accidents we're seeing with the highly automated cockpit systems. And so the challenges of keeping people focused and keeping them alert and keep them aware of the situation is one of the biggest challenges, really, of moving to a next-generation air traffic control system.
Well, I think it's important also to recognize that depending on the shift and location of the controller's job, whether it's pressured or not, it's very different. For instance, at the Reagan National Tower, after midnight, there's not much going on, so you're not under a lot of pressure. Under any circumstances,
right,
you're not under a lot of pressure. You want pressure? Work in the tower at O'Hare at the peak periods. So let's make sure we understand the big differences in the jobs that individuals with the same titles will have. Secondly, we ultimately have to go to a computer-centric system. Now, this is something that the union is not supporting very much, if at all, and the FAA has now made certain that we're not going to have a computer-centered system when we need it. because what they've done is they've taken NextGen and broken it into two pieces. By 2018, what they're calling NextGen will still be human-centric. That is, you'll have all these people and even more of them running the system. Then they expect to get to the computer-centric system in the mid-20s. Well, they're not going to get there that fast, because from 18 to the mid-20s isn't enough time to transition. Instead of, the original plan was to go directly to the computer-centric system in order to handle the workload increases and the complexity increases. And we've abandoned that schedule in favor of another one. Now, I don't know why this was so, but I know the union is very happy about it, because they perceive this will keep the number of jobs rising in their union at least through 18 and for many years beyond, while we're getting ready to do the computer-centric system, and that is outrageous.
Bill Voss, let me get you the last word on this next-gen satellite system, and I know you have to run as well. What's the timeline for getting this new system into place that would really bring us into the modern aviation age?
Well, you've heard part of the timeline just described there, but the real problem is one of the challenges the FAA has is the amount of infrastructure they do have. Smaller countries, for example, Australia, have been able to modernize their systems much more quickly because they have simply one-tenth or one or less of the infrastructure, so they're able to change over rather rapidly. So the FAA has the challenge of changing a massive system while it's running at a high rate. That's caused some slowdowns in it. There's a lot of, if you will, transition or preparatory systems being put in, ERAM and other things, bunch of acronyms, and it's turning out not to be as easy as it was first thought. So I think you're just seeing a long ramp up to the capability, and then we're going to have the big question, will the airlines actually equip to use them? And that's something that we're going to have to look at, even from a macro financing standpoint. So there's a lot more policy challenges we have to look at in the next few years.
Another call from Dan in Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Dan. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Fine. Hi, Jane. How you doing?
Hi. Fine. Go ahead.
So I mean, where I work and where a lot of my friends work and family and everywhere else, you can see the statistics. Companies and employers are firing people, laying people off, and forcing the remaining folks to do more work. And there's all this talk about, okay, giving folks maybe 20 minutes to take a nap, but what about just putting more people on the job so that you don't have people having to work multiple shifts? And we have the crisis in the Massey coal mining industry. We had the clean energy plant here in Connecticut that had an explosion. It just seems to me that employers are getting their profits back not by producing more or doing better, but by forcing working people to work harder and faster for less money and longer hours.
Dan, thank you. Bill Voss, the FAA has ordered additional controllers to be added to some of these overnight shifts, and I think in 27 airports?
Oh, that's right. And so this is an interesting point, and I think I better explore real quickly. One of the problems air traffic control has is you're stuck with rotating shifts because you lose your skills if you stay permanently on the midnight shift. And the skills are very perishable with the controller, so that's why you do see the rotations, even though it's not optimal for fatigue. The second challenge you run into is when putting more people on by itself, if you still have bad policies, doesn't help. Canada did exactly that. Canada had this identical problem, had a lower-level scandal we didn't hear down here in the South, and put two people on positions and ended up with two people falling asleep. It's sort of like you just heard from the pilot a while ago. They put several pilots on a flight in order to allow for rest and make sure somebody's sharp when they get to the other side of the ocean. What we do in air traffic control would be take those pilots and force them all to sit in the cockpit and stare out the window all night, which doesn't give you fresh people at the other end.
Bill Voss, I really appreciate your time today. I know you have to go. Bill is CEO of the Flight Safety Foundation, an independent nonprofit organization focused on air safety. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Aaron and Christine, hold on. More after this break. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the FAA, air traffic controllers, and the whole system that keeps our planes in the air and is supposed to keep us safe. My guests this hour are Christine Negroni, who writes about aviation for the New York Times and runs a blog about flying lessons, and Aaron Gelman, who's a member of the FAA's subcommittee on air traffic management and an expert on aviation at Northwestern University. Here's a clip from the past. On August 3rd, 1981, President Ronald Reagan famously fired over 11,000 striking controllers for threatening the public safety and crushed the union forever.
I must tell those who failed to report for duty this morning, they are in violation of the law, and if they do not report for work within 48 hours, they have forfeited their jobs and will be terminated.
And a couple of comments on this point from our website, onpointradio.org. Bridget writes, has anyone made a connection here to Reagan breaking the controllers union once upon a time? That perhaps this is the natural consequence of lowering the bar. And John writes, if they don't want to encourage napping, they shouldn't have named an airport after Reagan. Here's a call. Shane is in Boston. Hi, Shane. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. I'm really glad that you brought that point up about Ronald Reagan. I read an article last month on Slate, actually, about this issue, and the author, I think it was Timothy Noah, really blamed a lot of the problems on Reagan because he fired so many people and hired so many young people in the early 1980s who are all hitting their mandatory retirement age now. And so, and I don't know how long it takes to train, but it seems like it takes quite a while to train new air traffic controllers, and there just aren't enough.
I hear you. Let's ask Christine about that. Christine Negroni, is there a connection to that action so many years ago?
Well, there was a difficult time getting enough air traffic controllers, and a big push was on in the past few years to hire more air traffic controllers. But that's not something one of your earlier callers suggested. You know, more air traffic controllers, boom, just hire them. It's not that simple. There's a lot of training and a lot of at least a year or two before an air traffic controller goes from being trained to actually being proficient on a particular position. So it's not as easy as all that. But yes, the firing of PATCO employees definitely has an impact that's still being felt today. And those new hires are at retirement age today. So that there is definitely a cause and effect.
Aaron Gelman, do you agree?
Basically, yes, but I think Reagan did the right thing. I think he had to assert the government's primacy on people living up to their contracts, and these controllers do have contracts. But one of the things we haven't even addressed is Congress and their role in all of this. Congress stands in the way of modernization of the air traffic system in various ways. For example, one of the key points to get to the benefits of NextGen is consolidation of facilities. When FAA tried a couple of years ago to move 8 people, I think it was, from Boise, Idaho to Denver to consolidate and make it more efficient, Congress rose up in righteous indignation and stopped all transfers of people for consolidation purposes. That is outrageous, and Congress is really not going to get out of the way. And, of course, many of us feel that in the long run, the only answer is privatization, or corporatization, as a better word, perhaps, of the FAA's air traffic management system.
Do you see it that way, the corporatization of that system, Christine?
I would never even venture into that argument with a professor at Kellogg.
It's not an argument, it's a statement. I mean, I think that's the only way we're going to get through.
See, that's why I wouldn't even enter into the conversation, because even my terminology gets an argument.
Here's another call from Dave in somewhere along Interstate 495 in Massachusetts. Hi, Dave, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've been a union truck driver for 38 years, so mm-hmm. In 1981, it's forever burned in my memory when the PATCO strike, which was over a health and safety issue, because my memory is that the key issue was they wanted to reduce work week like air traffic controllers had in Europe. And ironically, PATCO Union was one of the few unions, if not the only one, that endorsed Reagan, you know, in the 1980 election, because he met with them seeking their endorsement, saying that he was sympathetic to their demand for a shorter work week. And he reeled them in, thinking, you know, that they were going to, you know, get some state bargaining out of the government on a key health and safety demand, that fatigue was something they really had to face and deal with. And then when the government wouldn't negotiate, Reagan turned around and fired him. And we're still dealing with this fatigue issue 30 years later. And, you know, at a tremendous cost, you know, to the American worker over the last 30 years, because that was a real signal to corporate America to begin an attack on organized labor. When one of your guests earlier had said that, you know, craft unions, you know, they need to take pride in their work and they should take more pride in their work. You know, air traffic controllers 30 years ago, that was what that was all about, you know, was that issue.
I'm glad you called, Dave. I think both of our guests had agreed with you. Let's get to another call. Tom in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Real quick, a few comments. First off, when this first came about, I was flabbergasted that these air traffic controllers are suspended on such a critical job that they're suspended and not fired. Mm-hmm. But then also for the government to turn around and the solution be it that if you don't have enough work to keep one person busy on a particular shift, and the solution is to throw a second person on the shift, I think is not addressing the core issue of the problem, which is that, you know, these people, and I want to sound biased. I mean, I'm a blue collar worker, and you know, I when I show up to work, I need to do my job and mm-hmm. be prepared for it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you choose to take a shift that's at night, you should be prepared that you're going to stay awake for that instead of having somebody to keep your company while you're doing nothing.
Tom, thank you. Here's Daniel from New London, Connecticut. Hi, Daniel. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I just had a comment. I understand industries can have their up and downs, but when a service is plagued with problems, I should be able to vote with my feet. But when the only viable alternative to air travel would be high-speed rail, and that doesn't exist in the U.S. today, I think we're not really given any other options as to, give the shock that the airline market should have by losing patronage to elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to comment that, you know, I think the repercussions are going to be heavily dependent upon government reaction, as I'm sure everyone's aware. But it's unfortunate because I can't choose to take, say, a train to Chicago. It takes, 2 days, which is really unrealistic.
We'd like a realistic alternative. Daniel, thank you. And one more from Barry in Lakeville, Massachusetts. Hi, Barry. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. I've got a question. You may be aware that, you know, railroad engineers that drive locomotives have a thing called a dead man's handle.
Mm-hmm.
And if they let up on the pressure on the handle, it sounds an alarm in the cab and actually applies the brakes. Why can't air traffic controllers, maybe they already have this, I don't know, have a similar system? If they fall asleep, they've got to keep pressing some button every minute. If they fall asleep, sound an alarm. Also, if a pilot is in a plane and doesn't get a response from a control tower, why can't he put a tone on the radio that sounds an alarm in the control tower? These would be simple technological fixes for what is actually a human problem, people falling asleep at night. And I wonder why they don't do that.
Barry, thank you. Christine, do you know of such backup systems in control towers?
I do, in fact, know that in Boston they're working on some sort of technology that does monitor facial cues for signs of inattention, and they're already being used. That kind of technology is being used in places where they use heavy earth-moving equipment. It's not being applied to aviation now, but I'm certain that company is, you know, plugging away at trying to make that happen. But I really feel like I will be remiss if I don't make this point, Jane, and that is that it's not that more air traffic controllers are falling asleep right now. It's not that more pilots are fatigued right now. We're also in sort of the perfect storm of media attention in which events get blown up, you know, for whatever reason. They've videos have appeared on YouTube, or, you know, people are Twittering about it. Events get blown up, and then the subsequent reported when previously they might not have. So we're really looking at a distorted picture, which I think is what makes people like one of your ring up and say, you know, I don't want to fly. Flying is completely unsafe. I think we have a very distorted picture of aviation.
So they're not more of these incidents necessarily now. They're just being more heavily reported.
They're being reported, which is not to say these are not real problems. They are. But, you know, but when people start saying things like, oh, it's so unsafe to fly, and, you know, you have to really put this in perspective. You can't, it's like when you go on a vacation and you see the picture of the view from your room, it looks so nice in the computer, but when you're actually there, of course, it's much bigger, it's much better. That's like the reality. We see YouTube and think that's the whole picture of aviation, but of course it's not. It's much safer. It's much more structured than these little scare stories would have us believe. I just blogged about this today, you know, the horror story of aviation, because this past month has been one piece of shocking, you know, scary aviation news after another. But we have to really step back and say, you know, because if we don't, we will have these kinds of knee-jerk reactions that are not well thought out, that are reactive rather than proactive. So, you know, to take a deep breath and look at this from a 10,000-foot altitude, I think would be very beneficial. It's hard, but it's important.
Hearing what Christine just said, Aaron, well, let me ask you about this, because you're a member of the FAA's subcommittee on air traffic.
I don't speak for the subcommittee.
But I know you don't, but you sit on the committee, and I'm just curious if you're hearing about any changes or, you know,
yes,
how you view this,
yes,
being a member of that committee.
They talk about changes all the time, but they come too slowly,
mm-hmm,
I think it's largely because of lack of leadership. But I want to make a point, related to something you said at the very beginning. You
okay.
said, is it a problem of too many planes in the sky? You better get used to a lot more planes in the sky, because the United States is dependent on mobility, and air transportation provides more mobility than any other form of transportation when you get out of the urban environment. And it's going to be that way probably as far as man can see. And I think we were looking at three times the base load, which I think was in 2005, something like that, in 2025. Well, it may not quite reach three times, but it sure is going to be more than double aircraft in the sky if we meet the demands of the public for mobility by air, and that includes air freight to some extent, domestically and greatly overseas, internationally. So let's get realistic and recognize we have to go to advanced air traffic systems, and that this business of fatigue is important, but it's a very minor issue, mm-hmm, when you look at the total situation.
Professor, I am going to press you on this point about being a member of the FAA Subcommittee on Air Traffic Management, because I want to know if systemically there are going to be changes. I mean, not just with Next Gen, but leadership issues, structural systemic changes after this.
I can't speak to whether they're going to change the leadership, but I will say that they're gradually putting some things in. I wish we had time to talk about the ADS-B story, which is really the guts of the Next Gen. It's it's two different forms. One form is being installed now under a contract, multi-billion-dollar contract, but it has no value to any aircraft operator, with one exception, so the airlines are not willing to equip. So what has the FAA done? They've agreed to buy the equipment and get it installed in JetBlue aircraft flying along the East Coast and into the Caribbean. Well, that's not going to get any of the other airlines to spend hard-earned money, mm-hmm, to fulfill that requirement. But if they did ADS-B in, which is the other variety, the airlines gain enormous benefits from it, and I think they would, no pun intended, flock to equip with it. In fact, FedEx and UPS, among others, are already put in, out and in, and the benefits are tremendous, as they have been for Alaska Airlines, which has done it much earlier than anybody else.
Very good. Let me get a couple more calls in here from Victor in Somerville, South Carolina. Hi, Victor. Welcome.
Thank you. I think that the baseline problem of this thing, which nobody is talking about, they keep rationalizing these controllers' behavior, performance with our technology, saying and need to install this kind of technology and that kind of technology. Technology has nothing to do with it. It sounds like these guys are not getting no sleep at night. And I understand that they have families, they have responsibilities, but you have to consider the seriousness and the responsibilities that you have on your job. I think they need to drug test all of them to start with, okay? Drug test them, and if they pass the drug test, then okay, they take it from that point of view.
Well, that's another issue, and we'll get to that maybe another time. Victor, I'm glad you called. Here's Bob in Mason City for our last listener today. Bob, welcome.
Welcome, Jane. I think this is a nationwide problem, whether you're in the airline industry, whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, a nurse, working at McDonald's. It's corporate America trying to do more with less employees. I think it's a nationwide problem.
Bob, thank you. Christine Negroni, just finish us off here by helping us understand the workload and the complexity of the issues that are going on with air traffic controllers and more broadly our civil aviation system.
Well, there are two issues. There's fatigue, but there's also the larger question. Excuse me, there's fatigue, but there's also the larger question of complacency. And that speaks to this air traffic controller today, or was it yesterday, who was found to be, watching a movie while he did his job. There's the mind craves stimulation. And when in these moments of downtime, people will, if they can't monitor, they will look for something else. And so, as we talked about earlier, as the aviation world gets more complex, it creates new mental challenges for the people who have to, who oversee the safety of it, the safe operation of airplanes, the safe operation of air traffic. So I think these are very big challenges, and the more we learn about the human mind, the more challenging it becomes to ensure the peak performance out of people. So these are, these are big issues. They're very big issues, but that doesn't explain why it's taken so long to crack down and say, how are we going to handle this in the most effective way? That's good for the employee. That's good for the traveler. That's good for the system.
Christine Negroni writes on aviation for the New York Times. She runs a blog called Flying Lessons. And Professor Aaron Gelman, professor of management at Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University and an expert in civil aviation and air traffic control issues. I know you both are in high demand the last couple of days. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.